Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Station Road by Anne Bridge. There was a little pause when the last speaker finished. We sat round the fire, each occupied with his own thoughts, the mind of each seeking its own solution of the problems raised by the uncanny story to which we had just listened. It was Treadgold who broke the silence. "That was a good story." "Very," he said meditatively, filling a fresh pipe. "I always wish the psychologists could get us a little nearer to understanding these happenings, or appearances, or whatever you like to call them. Sometimes they look like communications, and sometimes they don't." He lit a pipe carefully and then turned around his chair towards his immediate neighbor. "I always think that business of your wife's doctor was one of the oddest I ever heard in that line." "The train story, said Dr. Freeland. "Yes, that was a queer business. Of course, we were urgent with the doctor to let us have it." "Very well," he said, "you shall." He also made preparation for a fresh pipe, pushing his chair back a little from the fire. "It happened when we were living in the country," began the doctor, stuffing his tobacco well down into the bowl. "I had no practice then, but a mixed sort of job, doing hospital work in London 2 or 3 days a week, and relieving a man at that big private place at Wisleigh over the weekends. It was rather an up-and-down sort of life, but it suited him, and it suited me. One day, it was early in the week, a Tuesday, I think, I got a letter in town from a man I used to know well, saying that he was returning to England by a certain boat and wished to see me at once when he arrived. I had, well, looked after him to some extent in old days, and he had gotten into the habit of coming to me for advice and so on. But he had been in Canada for several years, and I had seen very little of him. I had not seen him since my marriage, and he had never seen my wife. He was urgent about the necessity for seeking me immediately, but he did not say what the trouble was. Well, I looked up the boat in the paper and then rang up the London office of the line, and I found that she was due to arrive at Plymouth 2 days later. In those days, the boat trains used to slip a coach at Westbury, and from there a fast train up the other line slipped a couple of coaches at Headworth Junction, about 7 miles from us. There was an hour's wait at Westbury, but it was far quicker than going right up to town by the boat train and down again. So I sent off a wire to this man to meet him with him at Plymouth, telling him to come to Headworth in this way, and I wrote a letter too, bidding him welcome. Also, I sent a line to my wife and told her to meet the 7:11 at Headworth to fetch off this man. I explained who he was, for I couldn't be sure of getting down myself that night. But my wife is quite accustomed to having casual strangers shot onto her, and I knew she would deal with him well enough till I got home. The doctor paused, lit another match, and puffed at his pipe. "I must say I thought it a little odd," he went on, "that he should want to urgently see me right off the boat, as it were. But I suppose he was in some trouble, and he had gotten to that habit, as I said, of coming to me for help. Well, it is generally the wrong thing that one thinks odd. But my wife, like a good sensible creature as she is, thought nothing odd at all. She prepared a room and a dinner and then set off in the car to meet the stranger at the junction. I always rode my old motorbike in and out, so that she did not have to worry about meeting me. It was early winter, November. By the time she started, it was black dark. Of course, we both knew the station road painfully well. There wasn't a bump in the whole 7 miles that we weren't perfectly familiar with. It's a very ordinary bit of South Country road, first a straight stretch between pastures, clay with oaks and hedgerows for about 3 miles, then a patch of thick woodland, and after that the road climbs over the open downs before it drops to the valley, where the river, the main road, and the railway all run together. It was a cold, dry, cloudy night with no moon. My wife told me how she noticed, perhaps for the 100th time, as she drove along, how white the dry road looked, except where the fallen leaves had moistened and stained it, and how the light from her lamps
picked up the trunks of the oak trees as she passed them one after another. She was keeping rather a sharp lookout on the foot passengers, because she had expected that a young brother of hers might be turning up that evening. He used to come, very casually, by any train, and walk out from the junction with a knapsack. So she was, as I say, keeping a particularly sharp lookout, and somewhere about the middle of the first flat straight stretch I spoke of, she saw a man on foot coming towards her, walking on the right-hand side of the road. She slowed down, she said, the least little bit to have time to see him. It wasn't Jim, her brother. It was a medium tall man in a very pale raincoat, which looked almost white in the strong light. She observed him, even when she had seen that it wasn't Jim, with a sort of involuntary precision with which one sometimes takes in unimportant details, and she noticed that there was a dark stain or mark showing up very clearly on the left side of this white trench coat of his, and that he had a very noticeable cast or twist of his right eye and eyebrow. Of course, she paid no attention to this at the time, but just registered the impression automatically, as it were. Well, she drove on perhaps another couple of miles, and was well into the stretch of woods, young beeches planted thick, so that the trunks looked like rain in a dim light, when she saw ahead another man walking towards her, again on the right-hand side of the road. She had met one or two cars and cyclists in between. It wasn't a particularly lonely road by any means, but nothing had passed her. She began to look carefully at this man, as before, as soon as she saw him. And as she got nearer, and could see him in increasing detail, she noticed first that he too had a very pale raincoat, and then that it had a dark stain on the left side. And then, as she actually passed him, and could see his face clearly, she saw that he had the same cast of the right eye and eyebrow as the man she had passed a couple of miles further back. It was the same man. She said that the full strangeness of it didn't strike her instantly. She was puzzled for a few seconds as to where she had seen him before. Then, as she remembered, she had a pronouncedly disagreeable sensation. She wasted a few moments more trying to make some hypothesis to account for the disquieting facts. It is the way we all treat disquieting facts. But it wouldn't do. She knew she had seen him. She knew where she had seen him. She remembered distinctly that nothing had passed her, going the same way as herself. She could not cheat herself into the belief that it wasn't the same man. Her involuntary and spontaneous attention in both cases had registered too clear and sharp an impression for that. She began to feel very uncomfortable indeed. It was then that she looked back. But in the woods the road was no longer straight. It curved a good deal, and quick as her thoughts had passed, she had covered a good stretch. The man would, anyhow, she realized, have been out of sight. The road behind her was, of course, empty. Between the chalky banks and gray walls of trees, which she could see of it, for the road behind your lights is very black, she drove on, but she was not perceptibly glad to meet another car or two, and she had a strong desire not to see any more foot passengers, nor after that first pause had she any further wish to look back. Somehow the blackness of the road behind her, in that one glance, had begun to let her something like horror in on her. She pushed on at a good pace, shoving the car up the long hill onto the down. Right at the top there is a signpost at four crossroads. Her light picked up the white post at a good distance, and she was glad to see it, for it meant that her drive was nearly over. There remained only the drop down to the valley and the station. But the next moment she saw that there was a man under the signpost. She stood on the accelerator, determined in a panic-stricken way not to look at him. But she had to look. She couldn't help herself. And she saw as she rushed past in a pitiless light, again the white raincoat, the dark stain on the left side, the twisted eyebrow, and the cast eye. This time she was terrified. For a little while, she said, she quite lost control of herself, and raced along blindly, her one idea to get to lights and faces and human speech. She found herself descending the hill at a perfectly reckless pace, and the sense of actual physical danger pulled her together. There's a bad turn at the pitch of the hill. She managed to slow down for that and drove on more reasonably to the station. She left the car outside and fairly ran in. It was 10 minutes past 7 by the station clock. The lobby was warm and brightly lit. Passengers and porters were moving about, and the whole place was so normal that it steadied her. The old station master, who was a great ally of ours, came up and began to talk to her, and his fatherly chat added to her comfort. He asked whom she had come to meet. She told him. The reflection that she would have a companion on the drive home made her almost at ease. They went out together onto the platform and stood waiting for the express. It was fairly late, but at 7:32, the station master took out his watch and checked the fact aloud. It came roaring through, and the slip coaches, grinding and groaning on the metals, came to a stop well up the platform. "Now we'll find your gentleman for you, ma'am," said the old boy. Well, they didn't find him. The coaches emptied themselves, and people collected their luggage and began to leave the station in the waiting cars, or foot, but no one appeared to be hanging about in the inquiring way so easy to spot of the total stranger who hopes to be met. They were puzzled. The station master consulted the guard, who took charge of the slip coaches from Westbury to Hedworth, and stopped with them at the latter place. "This lady's come to meet a gentleman off the boat train. Should have taken this train at Westbury." What was the name, the guard wanted to know. "McMurdo," says my wife. "Oh yes, he was there all right. The guard had his stuff in the van." They went to look, and there, sure enough, were three boxes with his name and the steamer labels. But there was by this time no one on the platform but themselves and the porters. "Well, that's a puzzle," said the guard, lifting his hat and rubbing his head. "I saw him at Westbury, took his stuff and talked to him. An American gentleman, isn't he? Talk like one, anyway." Then the blow fell, as it were. My wife was up to now merely rather annoyed and bored by the man's not turning up. She was standing quite at ease under the lamps when the guard called out to the porter, who had been collecting tickets as the passengers went out. "George, seen a gentleman go out in a white Macintosh with a twitch in his right eye?" "What do you say?" she said to the guard, so sharply that she saw his surprise. But she was too agitated to care. "What do you say he was like?" she repeated. "Why, he's a tallish gentleman, isn't he?" said the guard, "and he had on a whitish coat, and this twitch in his eye, sort of affliction. I noticed in particular." "That's right, isn't it?" Of course it was. The horror lay just in the guard having seen so precisely what she had seen. She was on the point of asking if the white Macintosh had a dark stain on the left side, when she remembered that for the purposes of a sane world, a world of guards and porters, she hadn't seen the man at all. She couldn't have, you see. The guard had seen him at Westbury, and no earthly power could have got him onto the station road where she had seen him before 7 o'clock. For the second time that night, she pulled herself together and asked the proper rational questions. Was he sure he had seen him get into the train? How did he know his name, that it was a man? The guard was quite positive and clear. The express was late in leaving Westbury, and this gentleman came fidgeting up to him and asked when the train would start. He gave me his luggage for the van, so I saw the name, and he asked for the refreshment room, and I showed him. We had quite a chat. He was very free, like most American gentlemen, in his talk. I should remember him, he said, the guard, for he gave me half a Bradbury for that. A great roll of notes he had on him. Well, there was no doubt about it. McMurdo, she had clearly seen, but you can guess that my wife took no very active part in the search of the empty carriages that followed. They found nothing. The one carriage was a litter of papers which the guard tossed over a little carelessly. Of McMurdo, there was no trace, nor did my wife expect to find him. She guessed him to be in another world. Poor soul, he was, sure enough. Next morning, when the slipped coaches were cleaned, bloodstains were found on the seat and floor of the carriage, which had been full of scattered newspapers. And before 24 hours were out, a gang of plate layers, making their daily round of that section, came on the corpse of a man lying halfway down the embankment of the line between Westbury and Armley. He had fallen with violence, but the fall was not the cause of death. A great stain of blood on the left side of his pale raincoat marked where he had been cruelly stabbed, murdered. There could be little doubt, for the sake of the great roll of notes, which the guard had noticed when he got his tip. His watch, ring, and so on had not been touched, nor anything but his money, and among the papers which easily identified him was my letter of welcome telling him his train. doctor paused and knocked out his pipe against the grate. That letter took me to the inquest, he went on, so I heard all that the police could put together. He was stabbed and thrown out at some time between 6:40 when the train left Westbury, late as you remember, and when it reached Armley, about 7:17. Armley was the one stop between Westbury and Hedworth, and my wife had been at the junction for some time when the train left that place. That is where the murderer must have got out, of course, someone put in. That was the supposition, said the doctor, but it was confirmed afterwards. How? Asked five voices at once. That's the most curious part of all, said the doctor. Over a year later, my wife was at the junction again, in the evening, to meet me this time. She's a courageous creature, and she did not let her distaste for the station road after dark keep her off it for long. Poor soul, she said more than once, he wanted help, and he was coming to you for it as usual. That was all. I wish I could have helped him. Well, there she was at the station, and this time the down train was late. She was sitting in the waiting room, looking at the paper, just under the lamp when a man came in. She looked up, as one does, when she heard him. So the light fell, I suppose, on her face. There was no one else in the room. Well, when this man saw her, she said that his whole face changed. Went ghastly, was her expression. He almost staggered back a step or two, and then turned it and went out like a man, but received a blow. She was rather upset, as you may suppose, at producing this effect on a total stranger, and actually went and tried to look at herself in one of those faded pictures of ocean liners which always hang in waiting rooms. She could find nothing odd in her appearance, so she went on reading the paper. Presently, something made her look up, and there was the man again, peering in through the window which gave onto the platform. He went on hanging about for a bit, and at last came in, looking shockingly disordered, and said that he must speak to her. She made him sit down, for he was shaking in every limb, and there and then he made a full confession of the murder of my poor friend. My wife thought at first that he was raving, but there could be no mistake. He gave the name, the date, and the time of the train. He had been desperate for money, had seen the notes when McMurdo tipped the guard at Westbury, and on a sudden impulse had committed the murder. He got out at Armley, as the police had surmised, and got clear away. But why in the world, someone began. Did he tell my wife, said the doctor? Exactly. She asked him that. And you must make what you can of his answer. You should tell this to the police, she said. Why have you told me? Because you were there, he said. How do you mean there? Says my wife, startled. You came and looked at me, said the poor wretch, trembling like a leaf. Three times while I was putting the papers about. Before I got to Armley, you stood at the door and looked at me. You don't suppose I could forget your face? He almost shrieked. I knew that one day I should see you again, and then I should have to tell you. The doctor paused again, but this time nobody said anything. There, he said after a few moments. Make what you like of that. We asked what became of the murderer. Oh, we handed him over to the police, said the doctor. One could do nothing else, and he wished it. But before he could be tried, he went completely insane. And he's in the asylum now, I believe. And what do you make of it yourself, doctor? Treadgold asked after another pause. The doctor leaned forward and knocked out his pipe for the last time against the grate. God knows, he said. The July Goes by A.S. Byatt. I think I must move out of where I'm living, he said. I have this problem with my landlady. He picked the long bright hair off the back of her dress, so deftly that the act seemed simply considerate. He had been skillful at balancing glass, plate, and cutlery, too. He had a look of dignified misery, like a dejected hawk, she was interested. What sort of problem? Amatory? Financial or domestic? None of those really, well, not financial. He turned the hair on his finger, examining it intently, not meeting her eye. Not financial. Can you tell me? I might know somewhere you could stay. I know a lot of people. You would, he smiled shyly. It's not an easy problem to describe. There's just the two of us. I occupy the attics, mostly. He came to a stop. He was obviously reserved and secretive, but he was telling her something. This is usually attractive. Mostly? Encouraging him. Oh, it's not like that. Well, not. Shall we sit down? They moved across the party, which was a big party on a hot day. He stopped and found the bottle and filled her glass. He had not needed to ask what she was drinking. They sat side by side on a sofa. He admired the brilliant poppies bowled on her emerald dress and her pretty sandals. She had come to London for the summer to work in the British Museum. She could really have managed with microfilm in Tucson for what little manuscript research was needed, but there was a dragging love affair to end. There's an age at which, however desperately happy one is in stolen moments, days, or weekends with one's married professor, one either prizes him loose or cuts and runs. She had had a stab at both, and now considered she had successfully cut and run. So it was nice to be immediately appreciated. Problems are capable of solution, she said as much to him, turning her soft face to his ravaged one, swinging the long, bright hair. It had been a year ago, he told her in a rush, at another party, actually. He had met this woman, the landlady in question, and had made, not immediately, a kind of faux pas. He now saw, and she had been very decent, all things considered, and so. He had said, I think I must move out of where I am living. He had been quite wild, had nearly not come to the party, but could not go on drinking alone. The woman had considered him coolly and asked, why? One could not, he said, go on in a place where one had been blissfully happy and was now miserable, however convenient the place. Convenient, that was, for work and friends and things that seemed, as he mentioned to them, ashy and insubstantial compared to the memory and the hope of opening the door and finding Anne outside it, laughing and breathless, waiting to be told what he had read or thought or eaten or felt that day. Someone I loved left, he told the woman. Reticent on that occasion, too, he bit back the flurry of sentences about the total unexpectedness of it. The arriving back and finding only an envelope on a clean table and spaces in the bookshelves, the record stack, the kitchen cupboard. It must have been planned for weeks. She must have been thinking it out while he rolled on her, while she poured wine for him, while... No. Vituperation is undignified, and in this case, what he felt was lower and worse than rage. Just pure, childlike loss. One ought not to mind places, he said to the woman, but one does, she had said. I know. She suggested to him that he could come and be her lodger. Then she had, she said, a lot of spare room going to waste, and her husband wasn't there much. We've not had a lot to say to each other lately. He could be quite self-contained. There was a kitchen and bathroom in the attics. She wouldn't bother him. There was a large garden. It was possibly this that decided him. It was very hot, central London, the time of year when a man feels he would give anything to live in a room opening onto grass and trees, not a high flat in a dusty street. And if Anne came back, the door would be locked and the mortise locked. He could stop thinking about Anne coming back. That was a decisive move. Anne thought he wasn't decisive. He would live without Anne. For some weeks after he moved in, he had seen very little of the woman. They met on the stairs, and once she came up on a hot Sunday to tell him he must feel free to use the garden. He had offered to do some weeding and mowing, and she had accepted. That was the weekend her husband came back, driving furiously up to the front door, running in and calling in the empty hall, Imogen, Imogen, to which she had replied uncharacteristically by screaming hysterically. There was nothing in her husband, Noel's appearance, to warrant this reaction. Their lodger, peering over the banister at the sound, had seen their upturned faces in the stairwell and watched her settle into its usual prim and placid expression as he did so. Seeing Noel, a balding, fluffy-templed, stooping 35 or so shabby corduroy suit, cotton polo neck, he realized he was now able to guess her age, as he had not been. She was a very neat woman, faded blonde, her hair in a knot on the back of her head, her legs long and slender, her eyes downcast. Mild was not quite the right word for her, though. She explained that she had screamed because Noel had come home unexpectedly and startled her. She was very sorry. It seemed a reasonable explanation. The extraordinary vehemence of the screaming was probably an echo in the stairwell. Noel seemed wholly downcast by it, all the same. He had kept out of the way that weekend, taking the stairs two at a time and lightly, feeling a little aggrieved, looking out of his kitchen window into the lovely overgrown garden that they were lurking indoors, wasting all the summer sun. At Sunday lunchtime, he had heard the husband, Noel, shouting on the stairs, "I can't go on. If you go on like that, I've done my best. I've tried to get through. Nothing will shift you, will it? You won't try, will you? You just go on and on. Well, I have my life to live. You can't throw life away, can you?" He had crept out again onto the dark upper landing and seen her standing halfway down the stairs, quite still watching Noel wave his arms and roar, or almost roar, with a look of impassive patience, as though this nuisance must pass off. Noel swallowed and gasped. He turned his face up to her and said plaintively, "You do see I can't stand it. I'll be in touch, shall I? You must want, you must need, you must..." She didn't speak. "If you need anything, you know where to get me." "Yes." "Oh well," said Noel and went to the door. She watched him from the stairs until it was shut and then came up again step by step, as though it was an effort, a little, and went on, coming past her bedroom to his landing to come in and ask him, entirely naturally, please to use the garden if he wanted to and please not to mind marital rows. She was sure he understood. Things were difficult. Noel wouldn't be back for some time. He was a journalist. His work took him away a lot. Just as well. She committed herself to the just as well. She was a very economical speaker. So he took to sitting in the garden. It was a lovely place, a huge, heated, walled South London garden with old fruit trees at the end, a wildly waving, disorderly buddleia, curving beds full of old roses and a lawn of overgrown dense ryegrass. Over the wall at the foot was the common, with a footpath running behind all the gardens. She came out to the shed and helped him to assemble and oil the lawnmower, standing on the little path under the apple branches, while he cut an experimental serpentine across her hay. Over the wall came the high sound of children's voices and the thunk and thud of a football. He asked her how to raise the blades. He was not mechanically minded. "The children get quite noisy," she said, "and dogs. I hope they don't bother you. There aren't many safe places for children round here." He replied truthfully that he never heard sounds that didn't concern him when he was concentrating. When he got the lawn into shape, he was going to sit on it and do a lot of reading, try to get his mind in trim again, to write a paper on Hardy's poems on their curiously archaic vocabulary. "It isn't very far to the road on the other side, really," she said. "It just seems to be. The common is an illusion of space, really. Just a spur of brambles and gorse bushes and bits of football pitch between two fast four-lane main roads. I hate London commons." "There's a lovely smell, though, from the gorse and the wet grass. It's a pleasant illusion." "No illusions are pleasant," she said decisively and went in. He wondered what she did with her time. Apart from little shopping expeditions, she seemed to be always in the house. He was sure that when he'd met her, she'd been introduced as having some profession, vaguely literary, vaguely academic, like everyone else he knew. Perhaps she wrote poetry in her north-facing living room. He had no idea what it would be like. Women generally wrote emotional poetry, much nicer than men, as Kingsley Amis had stated. But she seemed, despite her placid stillness, too spare and too fierce. Grim for that. He remembered her screaming. Perhaps she wrote plath-like chants of violence. He didn't think that quite fitted the bill either. Perhaps she was a freelance radio journalist. He didn't bother to ask anyone who might be a common acquaintance. During the whole year, he explained to the American at the party, he hadn't actually discussed her with anyone. Of course he wouldn't. She agreed vaguely and warmly. She knew he wouldn't. He didn't see why he shouldn't, in fact, but went on for the time with his narrative. They had got to know each other a little better over the next few weeks, at least on the level of borrowing tea or even sharing pots of it. The weather had got hotter. He had found an old-fashioned deck chair with faded striped canvas in the shed and had brushed it over and brought it out to his mown lawn, where he sat writing a little, reading a little, getting up and pulling up a tuft of couch grass. He had been wrong about the children not bothering him. There was a succession of incursions by all sizes of children, looking for all sizes of balls, which bounced to his feet or crashed in the shrubs or vanished in the herbaceous border, black and white footballs, beach balls, with concentric circles of primary colors, acid yellow tennis balls. The children came over the wall, black faces, brown faces, floppy long hair, shaven heads, respectable dotted sun hats and camouflage cotton army hats from Millet's. They came over easily, as though they were used to it. Sandals, training shoes, a few bare toes, grubby sunburned legs, cotton skirts, jeans, football shorts. Sometimes perched on the top, they saw him and gestured at the balls. One or two asked permission. Sometimes he threw a ball back, but was apt to knock down a few knobby little unripe apples or pears. There was a gate in the wall, under the fringing trees, which he once tried to open, spending time on rusty bolts only to discover that the lock was new and obscure, and the key not in it. The boy, sitting in the tree, did not seem to be looking for a ball. He was in a fork of the tree nearest the gate, swinging his legs, doing something to a knot in a frayed end of a rope that was attached to the branch he sat on. He wore blue jeans and training shoes and a brilliant t-shirt, striped in the colors of the spectrum, arranged in the right order, which the man on the grass found visually pleasing. He had rather long blonde hair falling over his eyes, so that his face was obscured. "Hey, you, do you think you ought to be up there? It might not be safe." The boy looked up, grinned, and vanished, monkey-like, over the wall. He had a nice, frank grin, friendly, not cheeky. He was there again the next day, leaning back in the crook of the tree, arms crossed. He had on the same shirt and jeans. The man watched him, expecting him to move again, but he sat immobile, smiling down pleasantly and then staring up at the sky. The man read a little and looked up, saw him still there, and said, "Have you lost anything?" The child did not reply. After a moment, he climbed down a little, swung along the branch, hand over, dropped to the ground, raised an arm in salute, and was up over the usual route over the wall. 2 days later, he was lying on his stomach on the edge of the lawn, out of the shade this time, in a white t-shirt with a pattern of blue ships and water lines on it. His bare feet and legs stretched in the sun. He was chewing a grass stem and studying the earth as though watching for insects. The man said, "Hi there." And the boy looked up, met his look with intensely blue eyes under long lashes, smiled with the same complete warmth and openness, and returned his look to the earth. He felt reluctant to inform on the boy, who seemed so harmless and considerate, but when he met him walking out of the kitchen door, spoke to him and got no answer but a gentle smile before the boy ran off towards the wall. He wondered if he should speak to his landlady, so he asked her, did she mind the children coming in the garden? She said no, children must look for balls. That was part of being children. He persisted. They sat there too, and he had met one coming out of the house. He hadn't seemed to be doing any harm, the boy, but you couldn't tell. He thought she should know. He was probably a friend of her son's, she said. She looked at him kindly and explained. Her son had run off the common with some other children 2 years ago in the summer, in July, and had been killed on the road. More or less instantly, she had added dryly, as though calculating that just enough information would preclude the need for further questions. He said he was sorry, very sorry, feeling to blame, which was ridiculous, and a little injured because he had not known about her son and might inadvertently have made a fool of himself with some casual reference whose ignorance would be embarrassing. What was the boy like? She said. The one in the house? I don't talk to his friends. I find it painful. It could be Timmy or Martin. They might have lost something or want. He described the boy. Blonde, about 10 at a guess. He was not very good at children's ages. Very blue eyes, slightly built, with a rainbow striped t-shirt and jeans. Mostly, though not always. Oh, and those football practice shoes, black and green, and the other t-shirt, with the ships and wavy lines, and an extraordinarily nice smile, a really warm smile. A nice-looking boy. He was used to her being silent, but this silence went on and on and on. She was just staring into the garden. After a time, she said, in a precise conversational tone, "The only thing I want, the only thing I want at all in this world is to see that boy." She stared at the garden, and he stared with her until the grass began to dance with empty light
and the edges of the shrubbery wavered. For a brief moment, he shared the strain of not seeing the boy. Then she gave a little sigh, sat down neatly, as always, and passed out at his feet. After this, she became, for her, voluble. He didn't move after she fainted, but sat patiently by her until she stirred and sat up. Then he fetched her some water and would have gone away, but she talked. "I'm too rational to see ghosts. I'm not someone who would see anything there was to see. I don't believe in an afterlife. I don't see how anyone can. I always found a kind of satisfaction for myself in the idea that one just came to an end, to sliced off stop. But that was myself. I didn't think he, not he. I thought ghosts were what people wanted to see or were afraid to see. And after he died, and the best hope I had, it sounds silly, was that I would go mad enough so that instead of waiting every day for him to come home from school and rattle a letterbox, I might actually have the illusion of seeing or hearing him come in. Because I can't stop my body and mind waiting every day, every day. I can't let go. And his bedroom, sometimes at night I go in. I think I might just for a moment forget he wasn't in there sleeping. I think I would pay almost anything, anything at all, for a moment of seeing him like I used to, in his pajamas with his hair ruffled and that smile. When it happened, they got Noel, and Noel came in and shouted my name like he did the other day. That's why I screamed, because it seemed the same. And then they said, "He's dead." And I thought coolly, "Is dead? That will go on and on and on to the end of time. It's a continuous present tense. One thinks the most ridiculous things. There was thinking about grammar, the verb to be, when it ends to be dead. And then I came out into the garden, and I half saw, in my mind's eye, a kind of ghost of his face, just the eyes and hair coming towards me, like every day waiting for him to come home, the way you think of your son, which is pleasure when he's not there. And I thought, no, I won't see him because he is dead, and I won't dream about him because he is dead. I'll be rational and practical and continue to live because one must. And there was Noel. I got it wrong, you see. I was so sensible, and then I was so shocked because I couldn't get to want anything. I couldn't talk to Noel. I made Noel take away, destroy all the photos. I didn't dream. You can will not to dream. I didn't. Visit a grave, flowers, there isn't any point. I was so sensible. Only my body wouldn't stop waiting, and all it wants is to see that boy. That boy. That boy you saw. He did not say that he might have been another boy, maybe even a boy who had been given the t-shirt and jeans afterwards. He did not say, though, the idea crossed his mind that maybe what he had seen was some kind of impression from a terrible desire to see a boy where nothing was. The boy had had nothing terrible, no aura of pain about him. He had been, his memory insisted, such a pleasant, courteous, self-contained boy with his own purposes. And in fact, the woman herself almost immediately raised the possibility that what he had seen was what she desired to see, a kind of mix-up of radio waves, like when you overheard police messages on the radio or got BBC One on a switch that said ITV. She was thinking fast and went almost immediately to say that perhaps his sense of loss, his loss of Anne, which was what had led her to feel she could bear his presence in her house, was that had brought them, dare she say, near enough for their wavelengths to mingle, perhaps had made him susceptible. "You mean," he had said, "you are a kind of emotional vacuum between us that must be filled?" Something like that, she had said, and had added, "But I don't believe in ghosts." Anne, he thought, could not be a ghost because she was elsewhere with someone else, doing for someone else those little things she had done so gaily for him. Tasted little suppers, bits of research, a sudden vase of unusual flowers, a new bold shirt, unlike his own cautious taste, but suiting him, suiting him. In a sense, Anne was worse lost, because voluntarily absent, an absence that could not be loved because love was at an end for Anne. I don't suppose you will, now the woman was saying. I think talking would probably stop any mixing of messages, if that's what it is, don't you? But if he comes again, and here for the first time, her eyes were full of tears, if you must promise, you will tell me, you must promise. He had promised, easily enough, because he was fairly sure he was right. The boy would not be seen again. But the next day he was on the lawn, nearer than ever, sitting on the grass beside the deck chair, his arms clasping his bent, warm brown knees, the thick pale hair glittering in the sun. He was wearing a football shirt this time, Chelsea's colors. Sitting down on the deck chair, the man could have put out a hand and touched him, but he did not. It was not, it seemed, a possible gesture to make, but the boy looked up and smiled, with a pleasant complicity as though they now understood each other very well. The man tried speech. He said, "It's nice to see you again," and the boy nodded acknowledgement of this remark, without speaking himself. This was the beginning of communication between them, or what the man supposed to be communication. He did not think of fetching the woman. He became aware that he was in some strange way enjoying the boy's company. His pleasant stillness, and he sat there all morning, occasionally lying back on the grass, occasionally staring thoughtfully at the house, was calming and comfortable. The man did quite a lot of work, wrote about 3 reasonable pages on Hardy's original air blue gown, and looked up now and then to make sure the boy was still there and happy. He went to report to the woman, as he had, after all, promised to do that evening. She had obviously been waiting and hoping. Her unnatural calmness had given way to agitated pacing, and her eyes were dark and deeper in. At this point in the story, he found in himself a necessity to bow to the rise for the sympathetic American, as he had indeed already begun to do so. He had mentioned only a child who had seemed like the woman's lost son, and he now ceased to mention the child at all. As an actor in a story, with the result that what the American woman heard was a tale of how he, the man, had become increasingly involved in the woman's solitary grief, how their 2 losses had become a kind of folie à deux from which he could not extricate himself. What follows is not what he told the American girl. That may be clear at which point the valorized version coincided with what he really believed to have happened. There was a sense he could not at first analyze, that it was improper to talk about the boy, not because he might not be believed, that did not come into it, but because something dreadful might happen. He sat on the lawn all morning in a football shirt. Chelsea? Chelsea. What did he do? Does he look happy? Did he speak? Her desire to know was terrible. He doesn't speak. He didn't move much. He seemed very calm. He stayed a long time. This is terrible. This is ludicrous. There is no boy. No, but I saw him. Why you? I don't know. A pause. I do like him. He was a most likable boy. Some days later, he saw the boy running along the landing in the evening, wearing what might have been pajamas and peacock toweling, or might have been a tracksuit. Pajamas, the woman stated confidently when he told her his new pajamas. With white rib cuffs, weren't they, in a white polo neck? He corroborated this, watching her cry. She cried more easily now, finding her anxiety and disturbance very hard to bear, but it never occurred to him that it was possible to break his promise to tell her when she saw the boy. That was another curious imperative from some undefined authority. They discussed clothes. If they were ghosts, how could they appear in clothes long burned or rotted or worn away by other people? You could imagine they agreed that something of a person might linger, as the Tibetans and others believed the soul lingers near the body before setting out on its long journey. But clothes? And in this case, so many clothes. I must be seeing your memories, he told her. And she nodded fiercely, compressing her lips, agreeing that this was likely, adding, I'm too rational to go mad, so I seem to be putting it on you. He tried a joke. That isn't very kind to me to infer that madness comes more easily to me. No, sensitivity. I am insensible. I was always a bit like that, and this made it worse. I am the last person to see any ghost that was trying to haunt me. We agreed it was your memories I saw. Yes, we agreed. That's rational as we can be, considering. All the same, the brilliance of the boy's blue regard, his gravely smiling salutation in the garden next morning, did not seem like anyone's tortured memories of earlier happiness. The man spoke to him directly then. Is there anything I can do for you? Anything you want? Can I help you? The boy seemed to puzzle about this for a while, inclining his head as though hearing was difficult. Then he nodded quickly and perhaps urgently turned and ran into the house, looking back to make sure he was followed. The man entered the living room through the French windows, behind the running boy who stopped for a moment in the center of the room, with the man blinking behind him at the sudden transition from sunlight to comparative dark. The woman was sitting in an armchair, looking at nothing there. She often sat like that. She looked up across the boy at the man and the boy, his face for the first time anxious, met the man's eyes again, asking, before he went out into the house, "What is it? What is it? Have you seen him again? Why are you?" "He came in here. He went out through the door." "I didn't see him." "No. Did he? Oh, this is so silly. Did he see me?" He could not remember. He told the only truth he knew. "He brought me in here." "What can I do? What am I going to do? If I killed myself?" "I have thought of that. But the idea that I should be with him is an illusion. This silly situation is the nearest I shall ever get to him. He was in here with me." "Yes." And she was crying again. Out in the garden, he could see the boy swinging agile on the apple branch. He was not quite sure. Looking back, when he had thought, he had realized what the boy had wanted him to do. This was also at the party his worst piece of what he called bowlerization, though in some sense was clearly the opposite of bowlerization. He told the American girl that he had come to the conclusion that it was the woman herself who had wanted it, though there was, in fact, throughout no sign of her wanting anything except to see the boy, as she said. The boy, bolder and more frequent, had appeared several nights running on the landing, wandering in and out of the bathrooms and bedrooms, restlessly a little agitated, questing almost until it had come to the man that what he required was to be re-engendered, for him, the man, to give to his mother another child into which he could peacefully vanish. The idea was so clear that it was like another imperative, though he did not have the courage to ask the child to confirm it. Possibly this was out of delicacy. The child was too young to be talked to about sex. Possibly there were other reasons. Possibly he was mistaken. The situation was making him hysterical. He felt action of some kind was required and must be possible. He could not spend the rest of the summer, the rest of his life, describing non-existent t-shirts and blonde smiles. He could think of no sensible way of embarking on his venture. So, in the end, simply walked into her bedroom one night. She was lying there reading. When she saw him, her instinctive gesture was to hide, not her bare arms and throat, but her book. She seemed, in fact, quite unsurprised to see his pajama figured, and after she had recovered her coolness, brought out the book definitely and laid it on the bedspread. "My new taste in illegitimate literature. I keep them in a box under the bed. Anna Twigg, Medium, The Infinite High, The Spirit World, Is Her Life After Death?" "Pathetic," she proffered. He sat down delicately on the bed. "Please don't grieve so. Please let yourself be comforted. Please." He put an arm around her. She shuddered. He pulled her closer. He asked why she had had only the one son, and she seemed to understand the purport of his question, for she tried, angular and chilly, to lean on him a little. She became apparently compliant. "No real reason," she assured him. "No material reason. Just her husband's profession and lack of inclination. That covered it." "Perhaps," he suggested, "if she would be comforted a little, perhaps she could hope. Perhaps." "For comfort, then," she said dolefully and laid back, pushing Anna Twigg off the bed with one fierce gesture, then lying placidly. He got in beside her, put his arms around her, kissed her cold cheek, thought of Anne,
of what was never to be again. "Come on," he said to the woman, "you must live. You must try to live. Let us hold each other for comfort." She hissed at him, "Don't talk," between clenched teeth. So he stroked her slightly over her nightdress, breast and buttocks and long stiff legs, composed like an effigy on an Elizabethan tomb. She allowed this, trembling slightly and then trembling violently. He took this to be a sign of some mixture of pleasure and pain, of the return of life to stone. He put a hand between her legs, and she moved them heavily apart. He heaved himself over her and pushed unsuccessfully. She was contorted and loctite, frigid, he thought grimly, was not the word. Rigor mortis, his mind said to him, before she began to scream. He was ridiculously cross about this. He jumped away and said quite rudely, "Shut up!" And then, ungraciously, "I'm sorry." She stopped screaming as suddenly as she had begun and made one of her painstaking economical explanation. "Sex and death don't go. I can't afford to let go of my grip on myself. I hoped, well, you hoped, it was a bad idea. I apologize." "Oh, never mind," he said, and rushed out again onto the landing, feeling foolish and almost in tears for warm, lovely Anne. The child was on the landing waiting. When the man saw him, he looked questioning, and then turned his face against the wall and leant there, rigid, his shoulders hunched, his hair hiding his expression. There was a similarity between woman and child. The man felt, for the first time, almost uncharitable towards the boy, and then felt something else. "Look, I'm sorry. I tried. I did try. Please turn around." Uncompromising, rigid, clenched back view. "Oh, well," said the man, and went into his bedroom. "So now," he said to the American woman at the party, "I feel a fool. I feel embarrassed. I feel we are hurting, not helping each other. I feel that it isn't a refuge." "Of course you feel that," she said. "Of course you're right. It was temporarily necessary. It helped both of you. But you've got to live your life." "Yes," he said. "I've done my best. I've tried to get through. I have my life to live." "Look," she said, "I want to help. I really do. I have these wonderful friends I'm renting this flat from. Why don't you come just for a few days, just for a break? Why don't you? They're real sympathetic people. You'd like them. I like them. You could get your emotions kind of straightened out. She'd probably be glad to see the back of you. She must feel as bad as you do. She's got to relate to her situation in her own way in the end. We all have." He said he would think about it. He knew he had elected to tell the sympathetic American because he had sensed she would offer a way out. He had to get out. He took her home from the party, went back to his house and landlady without seeing her into her flat. They both knew that this reticence was promising, that he hadn't come in then because he meant to come later. Her warmth and readiness were like sunshine. She was open. He did not know what to say to the woman. In fact, she made it easy for him. She asked briskly if he now found it perhaps uncomfortable to stay, and he replied that he had felt he should move on. He was so little use. Very well, she had agreed, and had added crisply that it had to be better for everyone if all this came to an end. He remembered the firmness with which she had told him that no illusions were pleasant. She was strong, too strong for her own good. It would take years to wear away that stony clothes, simply surviving insensibility. It was not his job. He would go. All the same, he felt bad. He got out his suitcases and put some things in them. He went down to the garden, nervously, and put away the deck chair. The garden was empty. There were no voices over the wall. The silence was thick and deadening. He wondered, knowing he would not see the boy again, if anyone else would do so, or if, now he was gone, no one would describe a t-shirt, a sandal, a smile, seen, remembered, or desired. He went slowly up to his room again. The boy was sitting on his suitcase, arms crossed, face frowning and serious. He held the man's look for a long moment, and then the man went and sat on his bed. The boy continued to sit. The man found himself speaking. "You do see, I have to go. I've tried to get through. I can't get through. I'm no use to you, am I?" The boy remained immobile, his head on one side, considering. The man stood up and walked towards him. "Please, let me go. What are we in this house? A man and a woman and a child. And none of us can get through. You can't want that." He went as close as he dared.
He had, he thought, the intention of putting his hand on or through the child, but could not bring himself to fear there was no boy. So he stood and repeated, "I can't get through. Do you want me to stay?" Upon which, as he stood helplessly there, the boy turned on him again the brilliant, open, confiding, beautiful, desired smile.